Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their wonderful yearly writers' conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, I have only one concern, one small concern about today's guest, screenwriter, filmmaker, and now novelist, Soman Chainani. My only fear is that the rest of his life will somehow be disappointing compared to what he has lived so far, because from where I sit and from what I understand, it has been nothing but a string of surreal successes. It began, he was a undergraduate at Harvard University, where he graduated summa cum laude, went on to Columbia University Film Program, and he won the school's top prize, the FMI Fellowship for Writing and Directing. His short films Davy and Stu and Kali Ma have played to over 150 international film festivals and won him over 30 jury and audience awards and racked up over, 1 million YouTube hits and secured distribution in over 100 territories. Now, if that wasn't enough, his debut novel, The School of For Good and Evil, The School for Good and Evil, which is the first in a trilogy, just came out. It debuted at number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. I believe that was today. And get this, folks, only 2 hours ago, as of this recording, he signed a 7-figure deal with Universal for the film rights. Ah, I'm exhausted just listing all those. How is all this possible? I don't even know. I wonder if Soman does. Let's get him on the show and find out. Soman, welcome to Author to Author.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, holy moly, that's a very heady list of credits. You're still a young man. How are you doing? How are you holding up all this stuff?
It's crazy. I mean, the funny thing is, everything seems like an overnight success, you know, but I've been working, you know, in film now since I graduated film school. So that was 2008 or 2009. So it's been about 4 years. And I had a few creative miscarriages where I was meant to direct a movie, where we had been financed, where we were cast. You know, I had moved to London to direct my first feature and spent, you know, a year and a half preparing it, and we were fully financed by a studio, and I had lost that. And so just going through that process of, you know, having success and then losing it, or having something so, you know, close to your heart and something you were passionate about and losing it and not getting to bring it into the world, I think made me ready for the entire experience of the School for Good and Evil, because the reason I went from film into books was I wanted to be able to control something a little more. I felt like in film, it's such a dicey proposition because you're always depending on somebody else for the money. Yeah. And so, you know, from that movie falling apart is how I went straight into the School for Good and Evil. And so now that the success is here, it's okay to deal with in some way, because I know what it's like to not have it, you know, and if it was when it does disappear, and of course it will at some point, I'll be back to to ground zero, and a new project, whatever that's going to be, I'll be okay, you know. So,
you know, it was funny, someone, I was pacing around thinking what I might talk to you about, and that was one of the first things that came to mind, which is that I've had, you know, plenty of experiences that would be called failures, and I've had experiences that would be called successes, and both in their own way can pull me off my balance for different reasons.
Absolutely.
Each one can start. And so I was wondering, it seemed like you had, I mean, obviously you didn't list in your credits on your website the movie that didn't get made. So, but you had a lot of nice, you've brought a lot of things to fruition. And so this is my question, is how do you stay balanced? And for you, it's a sense of knowing that both things happen.
And also, you know, I was I'm still a big tennis player. I mean, like, that to me is is the thing in the world that I love the most and I'm actually best at. And if I was a bit of a bigger guy, I'd probably be a pro tennis player. And, you know, when I went to Wimbledon for my graduation present from high school, you know, like my parents saved up all this money so that I could get to go to Wimbledon. And I remember seeing the inscription on the gate, and it said, you know, something like, "May you treat triumph and a disaster both the same." And I saw that as like a 16-year-old, and that stayed with me, this idea of, you know, every time you go onto the court or every time you present a new creative project or anything in the world, may you, whatever happens, treat it the same way, you know? And so, I don't know, that stuck with me. And also, you playing tennis, you win and lose so much that you learn to treat them both the same, you know? So, I think, so you treat both the
same. Boy, I'll tell you what, if there's any piece of advice that I could stick into a 16-year-old brain, if I could do it, stand up at every high school graduation across the country, it would be that. Because for my own life, I know that, you know, I made a big transition when I stopped looking at success and failure, but only understood every experience as learning, because that was all that was going to happen either way.
Absolutely. And the funny thing is, I don't, you know, the success of the book right now and the, whatever's happening with the film and all those things, to me, doesn't change my opinion of the book. You know, like if people had hated it, I would have still had the same reaction. And the fact that people are being quite positive about it, still, you know, I still know the flaws inside of it. I still know the things that I want to fix for the sequel. It doesn't make me suddenly, you know, reconceive my own opinion of the world. And that's sort of a theme in the book also, is the ability to be able to look in the mirror and see what's actually there instead of what people are telling you is there.
Well, let's actually talk about the book a little bit. We don't want to give away too much, but, you know, it's a it really grabs you from the get-go. It's vivid and engaging right from page one. Just wonderful. But instead of me trying to explain it to the audience, why don't you let them know what they're in for when they pick up their copy of The School for Good and Evil?
You know, it's an interesting book, I think, in the sense of it's very different from most kids' books. And it's funny now to see the reactions rolling in from kids where they're a bit startled that they're dealing with something that looks so innocuous on the outside and it's such a subversive book on the inside, you know. And I grew up watching Disney movies exclusively because we didn't have cable and we didn't have the internet. So I just used to watch those VHS tapes of those classic Disney movies again and again until I had them memorized. And I just, that's the world I wanted to live in. But then you go to college, and I took a fairy tale seminar, you know, my first semester with Maria Tatar, who is the queen of fairy tales in the world. I mean, like, she is really the fairy tale expert. And she made us read the original tales over and over. And I thought,
it's very different, isn't it?
I mean, they're not even, you know, it's like Disney is like a travesty in comparison, because these are dark and scary and all those things. So that's when I became obsessed with this gap. I didn't understand why kids today couldn't handle, you know, the old stuff versus the new stuff. And what I wanted to do ultimately was tell a story about that gap. You know, so the trilogy is really about the gap between what we think we know and what actually is. So the second book's going to deal with the gap. Instead of the first book's about good and evil, the second book will be about the sort of gap between the male and the female, between boys and girls. So that, you know, so there's going to be sort of that clash between the masculine and the feminine. And the third book will be about old and young. So I'm just constantly looking at these things that we think we know, and then sort of digging into the space between them.
You know, it's so funny, Zone, because when I moved in with my wife when I was in my mid-20s, she was and is a big fan of fairy tales. And just as you described, she said, "No, let me show you the Grimm fairy tales. Let's read them." We sat there in bed and read them together. And it was so funny when I was reading the book, because you described very early on the scene where the witch, I think it's the witch, is put inside the barrel with nails and rolled down the street. That was her punishment, you know, and that was happening a number of times, as I recall, in the Grimm's fairy tale. That's how it ends, with the queen being rolled, or the evil witch being rolled down the street in the barrel full of nails. And I said to my wife, "What? I don't remember this from Disney." And they were all that way, kind of very dark and gritty and brutal in a way.
But also thrilling. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, this is, God, I'm going to get in so much trouble for saying this. But I feel like the great thing about fairy tales is they were, for children, sort of a substitute for the kind of, like, erotic thrill that adults get when they're older. So I always thought of fairy tales as kind of like this kind of like illicit like material for kids, because they didn't know, you know, obviously they hadn't gone through, you know, their own hormonal changes, so they didn't even know what was happening. But they still got some weird subliminal thrill from the subtext buried into it, you know. So it's, you know, children don't know really very much until obviously they turn 13, 14. But still at 8, 9, 10, and 11, you can sense taboo. You can sense kind of like the sort of deeper, darker meanings of things. And that's all in the Grimm's fairy tales. I mean, those tales are extremely lusty and dark and weird, but they were still read to 7 and 8, 9-year-olds who I think subliminally picked up on everything. So, you know, needless to say, the book is full of that. So,
well, I think one of the biggest mistakes you can make with children is to assume that they don't have the same feelings that adults do. They're just reduced down into the child's point of view. But my sons have asked, from very early on, were asking questions about death and their own mortality. But they were asking it from a child's point of view. But they were wrestling with the same, in a way, existential questions that we think are reserved only for teenagers and then, of course, middle-aged people.
Absolutely. Well, the funny thing about the book also is that, you know, one of my beefs with the children's book industry is that the gatekeepers, you know, a lot of the sort of like librarian, blogger, reviewers think in terms of adult books. So they're reading it like an adult book, and they don't understand the pace and the way children read stories sometimes, you know, and children can keep up in a much faster way than adults can. You know, and they can deal with a lot more information. They like their books longer, whereas librarians like the books shorter. So there's a lot of things that I think that we get wrong about kids as readers. You know, the funny thing is when I go to schools, and I've been on this crazy 10-city, 11-day tour, you know, where I'm just going, seeing like 800 kids a day, you know, with this book, is the number of kids who look at it and say, thank God it's long, you know, like versus...
Really?
Yeah, because they want something where they just want something big. It's just that whole more is better thing to kids at this point. You know, the reluctant readers, the ones who don't like reading, obviously when they see a big book are going to hide away from it. But the kids who read, they want a long book. And I think that you know, J.K. Rowling's probably responsible for making that happen. You know,
because well, I should say.
She really was the one who tapped into the fact that if you give kids a big, like episodic, serial-based novel that can go hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages, they will stay with you the whole way, you know.
Well, you know, when I was 13 and 14, I was reading Lord of the Rings, and I was reading Stephen R. Donaldson, and these were big, fat fantasy books, because there was no young adult fiction at that point in the early 80s, and I loved it. I could just sit with the book forever, and it would never seem to end, because it just went on and on, and I couldn't have been happier.
No, totally. It's like... The other thing is I felt like it was in that vein. I thought it was unfair that all – I call them map books, meaning books you open that have maps at the beginning always were about boys. You know what I mean? And, and they just were always about guys on a quest. And I felt like, you know, I want to write a book that boys will read, but let's have a girl on the quest. And one of the things with Harper I talked about early on is I wanted that map to be really beautiful. Like I wanted it to feel like you were going into an epic world even though you had a girl as your lead character, you know. So they ended up printing that map in full color just because of how important we knew it was, you know, which is rare, obviously, for a book. So it was just the idea of messing with those established Tolkien, you know,
conventions
of the boy on the journey. And now we sort of put two girls on the journey with a boy between them.
Right. That's awesome. Now, you mentioned earlier that you had, you know, you had this film project you were making. Was this a film project you had written?
Yes, it was. It was like sort of a labor of my life, and hopefully this whole process, I mean, wouldn't it be ironic if this is what ends up letting me make it ultimately? But it was the one I started in film school. It's this big, luscious wedding movie about, you know, an Indian family torn between two weddings that was very personal and very autobiographical. Right. And, you know, just it's a fun movie. And we were all financed, and then the financial crisis hit Europe, and suddenly the studio was just, it just, you know, they sort of disappeared for a while and all that stuff. So I used the downtime to work on the book, and then the whole book thing happened. So, you know, it was going from screenwriting straight into novel writing.
So I've done screenwriting and I've done novel writing, and to me they were, I mean, obviously there was a lot of similarities just in terms of the narrative, and dialogue is still dialogue and so on. But they're also very different experiences to me. And how did you find the transition? Because your training was not in fiction writing, it was in screenwriting, as I understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd never written fiction, like, you know, really before. I mean, I had here and there just for fun little things, but I'd never actually done it on a serious level.
Yeah.
So it was scary. It was scary also because we had sold the book before I started writing. So imagine writing a book you know is going to be a trilogy. Yeah, we sold it on a proposal. So there was no book. I had a release date. I had a release. I knew it was going to be a trilogy, meaning you had an entire corporation betting on this thing before a word was written. I knew that studios were already interested in the movie rights before I ever wrote a word of the book because the concept, you know. So the pressure was horrible. I mean, I was the funny thing is I used to just go home to my parents live in Miami. I used to go to their home and write a lot, you know, just take 2 weeks down there and write because I could get away from the craziness in New York. And looking back, I told my mom when all this was at the end of it, I said, was I as horrible as I think I was to everybody? She's like, you were the worst. She said, you were the worst because the pressure, you know, like just the pressure was almost crippling, you know, and thank God I have good friends and stuff who let me get away from it sometimes.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so you sold the rights to it. Okay, but did this feels to me like a story. It right away, it felt to me like a story that had been bubbling around in someone for a long time.
I think so. I mean, I think so. Right. It's almost like once I started writing it, it just went. And, you know, if I'm guilty of anything in this book, it's of trying to do a lot, you know, a lot at one time, because I just had a lot to say about, you know, all the things I had thought about and fairy tales and everything. And so I think it had been there all along, you know, and also because when you're preparing to direct a movie and you spend a year and a half working on it, then you don't get to make it, I think you're just ready to explode, you know? And so creatively, I just was ready to go on a run.
And so but you have to deal with the prose issue, you know? And
that was a big, big, massive issue because I wrote the first draft too much like a screenplay, and it caused us a lot of problems in editing. And in fact, the ARC, the first advanced reader's edition that goes out as your galley, which is supposed to be pretty much the final version, the whole second half of it, I hadn't gotten to edit out the screenplay stuff. So it reads very choppily and just exactly like a screenplay. It's like reading a screenplay version of the novel. And, you know, it haunted me because I didn't want sort of early librarians and readers having to read that version, but there was nothing I could do. And then I had another 8 months to edit and fix it. So, it sort of went through. I almost wrote it as a kind of like a screenplay first, and then went back and really just kind of smoothed it and paid attention to the language and did all those things. So the final version reads like a seamless novel, but it was difficult. And the second book, thank God, I've learned from my mistakes, and now I know exactly what I'm doing. But the first one was hard, definitely, very hard.
And so how did you this is a strange question, but how did you find your voice? When you think back on finding that narrative prose voice, what comes to mind most?
I think, you know, by seventh grade, I was already obsessed with storytelling, you know, and sort of the process of, you know, creating drama. And I always knew how to sort of extract drama from a moment from an early age. But I think I read a lot, and I think also I became good at kind of melding comedy into horror, you know, like, so just like fairy tales, which are sort of half comedy and half horror, you know. So I don't know. I think it came from a process of what I was reading and watching when I was young, and also that's how I was born. My dad used to call me America's storyteller when I was young because I just always made a story out of everything. I couldn't just tell a straight version of what happened. I had to make it as sort of dramatic as possible. Yeah.
Well, but I was just talking to Gregory Martin, who's written a couple memoirs, and we were talking about when you write a memoir, how you have to take your whole life and kind of reduce it down, or even a part of your life, but you have all this information. But in order to tell the story, you've got to reduce it down. And he quoted Georgia O'Keeffe, who said that there is nothing is less realistic than realism. And I feel that's the job of the storyteller is to emphasize and reduce so that you can feel the reality of the experience.
Completely. And I think the funny thing is I also find reality incredibly boring, like to just tell it exactly what happened. There's always, you have to sort of connect the pieces in a way to create the most drama possible. I mean, you look at a book like, yeah. One of my favorite books that I've ever read was Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which I've read so many times. And there is no way that book happened the way he says it did, you know, and there's just no way. But the way he crafts it is so beautiful that you just believe it. You know, I never had a problem with James Fry's whole thing with a million little pieces.
Right.
To me, you know, I assumed it was fiction. You know, I think it's harder when you have to do all the press for it, and that's when you get in trouble, you know, when you don't acknowledge that, and that probably was his error. But, you know, I think fiction and nonfiction ultimately, ever since, you know, In Cold Blood by Capote,
sure.
It's all about novelizing the experiences.
Well, sure. I mean, your past, you can't help but to fictionalize your past, because I've used this example before, but if I get into, say, an argument with my wife where, you know, it begins and 30 minutes later we finally wrap it up and we get into that place where we try to say, now, how did we get here? Each of us has a different memory of how we went through this, and that just happened 30 minutes ago. So how can we hope to have any idea of what the past really was? We don't know.
Absolutely. And also, please, who writes down conversations from their life, including their memoir, 30 years later? I mean, it's ridiculous that we would ever take any of it as literal.
Yeah. So here, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I know you essentially created a fairy tale major, I guess, at Harvard. Is that right? Or is this...
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that that's really what I was doing for 4 years, was taking classes that I thought would help me understand them better. And that's what I wrote my thesis on. That's what I wrote my junior thesis on. My freshman paper was on why there's no female Disney villains, you know, and why out of the 60 movies they've made, there's only 7, I think, female villains. And those are the 7 we remember and the ones we care about. So, yeah, I was obsessed with them in school.
All right, so perfect. So you're just the one to do this. Not only a storyteller, but a bit of an academic, too. So here I am. I'll say, you know, this fairy tales are great for little kids, but I am an adult. I live in the real world. I deal with bank accounts, and I read the New York Times, and I'm dealing with death and disease, and these are of no value to me. Mm. I can't understand why they would be. So what would you say to that voice, to that position?
Well, I just think adults. Yeah, I think adults need this book and the original fairy tales more than the kids, frankly. You know, because I didn't really write it for kids. I wrote it for the fact that adults grow up with this sort of Pollyanna vision that they teach kids, which is that good wins all the time, and that good is a goal that everyone should strive for. So one of the things I tell the kids when I go to meet them, and it's funny to see the adults' reaction to this in the room, is, you know, I'll be in front of a room full of 600 kids, let's say, like I was yesterday, and I'll say, say we all go to the beach, and we see this gorgeous sandcastle on the beach, right? How many of you want to leave it the way it is and not touch it? And you'll get maybe 30%. And I say, how many of you want to knock it down? And 70% raise their hand. And
right.
I'm like, this whole idea that, and then it's the same with babies. Some babies will put the Lego, an extra Lego, onto the Lego sculpture, and others will just knock it down. And you feel like some of us are meant to create, and some of us just want to destroy. And that's our instinct. And to say that, you know, the destroyers are bad people, I think fundamentally ignores instinct, you know. And I think one of the great things about the original fairy tales is they understand that the ones, some of us that are meant to destroy, you know, actually can find a happy ending. So that's what I think the book talks about, is just reshaping how we think about good and evil and getting rid of this idea of good always wins. Because once you think good always wins, you start to have preconceptions of what good means, which is good is beautiful, good is charming, good is polite, you know. And all in the School for Good in the book, the good characters are all of that. They are polite and beautiful and well-dressed and charming. But as you go deeper into the book, you realize how toxic we've turned good, you know, in our own sanitizing of the original fairy tale. So my answer to that would be right. That adults need the fairy tales in order to actually know what good actually means.
Right. And of course, funny about destruction, but out of destruction, I mean, if you knock a sandcastle down, now there's room for another sand. I mean, out of that destruction comes creation, invariably.
And it's not, it's funny, it's popping up all over the place. I saw it, I'm just reading Dan Brown's new novel, just because I'm fascinated by the way he researches and puts it into his writing. And he's this whole book, this new book, Inferno, is all about that. It's all about, you know, at some point, in order to creatively grow, in order to thrive, you have to destroy, you know? So he's looking at it from even a more practical perspective in that book. And you have to almost feel like he's believing it when he's writing it, you know, even though it's the villain's perspective. So,
but, Soman, that in a way is what happened to you. Although you didn't destroy it, your film was destroyed, you could say, by this freak, monetary disaster.
Yeah, absolutely.
And out of those ashes, in that empty space, new creation bloomed.
Totally.
What we call
bad
bad is often just our myopic perception of the moment, I think.
Absolutely. And I didn't get, I mean, I had, I remember after the movie fell apart, I got a fever for about 12 days. That wouldn't go away, and the doctors didn't know how to diagnose it, and everyone thought I was dying. And I just knew it was fine. You know what I mean? I knew, I felt like it was just some sort of weird rebirth. And as soon as that fever went away, that's when I got the idea for the book. So it was like, it happened, and I went straight to work, you know? So.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. Oh, it's so funny.
Totally.
Now, see, I had no doubt that that was a complete reaction to what had just happened.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was no medical, you know, everyone's trying to give you drugs, and I'm like, for what? What do I have? They're like, you have a virus. I was like, I have no cold. There are no symptoms. I just have a fever all day. They're like, you're going to die. Like, they kept giving me all these reasons that it was bad for me. I'm like, I'll be fine. You know, and so, you know, I was delirious, and I didn't know what was going on, but I felt like it was my body's way of just kind of resetting, you know, after working on something for so long.
That's perfect. Well, listen, I have time for one more question. I'd like you to answer. I'd like to ask all my writers, if writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
I think to breathe in a strange way, in that writing is the only thing where I actually feel like I'm engaged 100% and fully in the flow. It's the only, you know what I mean? Without it, I think, I don't know who I'd be. So it just taught me to be who I am at the end of the day, because without it, I'd be a much more stifled person. Let's put it that way.
Taught you how to be who you are, because you, in order to write, you have to be in the moment, right?
Yeah. And you have to feel, you know, like the one thing I'm going to learn more and more with more books. And so I almost tell myself, like, you know, to sort of calm myself down about expectations and stuff, is I say, you know, watch out for your fifth or sixth book, because you're learning to feel while you write. And so they're just going to get better. You know, they might not, you know, who knows? They might get worse plot-wise or whatever, but they will be more and more, you know, authentic and full with feeling, because I think writing's helping me get more and more in touch with myself.
See? And we come back to my motto, what it takes to write the book we want to write is what it takes to lead the life we want to lead, and who
it's
wants
true.
To lead a life without feeling?
It's true. Well,
I just heard a little bird in my ear tell me our time is up. Soman, thank you so much. Best of luck.
No,
I don't think you need it, but I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, everyone, you hear that? It's going to help him feel more deeply, and I can't agree more. Certainly, writing has taught me that. Thank you all for stopping by for this special edition. I'll be here next Tuesday talking with Terry Persun about what it takes to write within yourself. Until then, one of my best pieces of writing advice is to feel first, write second, because you can't write it if you can't feel it. So feel first, write second, and if you can, feel a little more. It's a good thing.